Terrorists maintain their grip on Mumbai, India today after a series of attacks that started across India's financial center Wednesday. About 150 people have been killed, including 22 foreigners, two of them Americans. It's unclear exactly who is responsible for these attacks. In a minute, we're going to check in on the situation at the Taj Mahal Hotel. That's one target where a fresh gun battle has just broken out. But first, we're going to go to Rahul Singh. He's a journalist who lives next door to another target in these attacks. It's called the Nariman House, an Orthodox Jewish center in Mumbai. And Rahul, can you tell me exactly what you're seeing?
The commandos blew up one of the rooms in one of the floors. The director general of the commandos came on television to announce that the two terrorists there have been killed by the commandos, but sadly, the terrorists killed the three hostages they had. Then they fled onto the floor above, where they killed two more people who were in that floor before they were shot down. And there are lots of crowd, big crowd there cheering the commandos and the army, but the sad part is that the hostages died.
And what does it look like?
This particular building, Nariman House, is in a very crowded locality. So it was, I think, quite a difficult operation because it's sort of, you know, all very boxed in together, all these buildings. And I think it was something that they did not expect, that the terrorists would go into this particular building. Mm-hmm. I think it took them by surprise.
And so when you say that there were crowds cheering outside, are they still there? Are the roads blocked with people who were cheering the commandos for putting an end to this?
Yes, the roads are now less blocked, but there were hundreds of people, if not thousands of people there, mm-hmm. because they were watching this for the last 2 days.
What is the mood like there? I imagine that most people must be very tense.
Yeah, you know, but you know, somehow Mumbai and India somehow come to live with this because we've had terrorism now for the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, almost every major city has been attacked by terrorists. And luckily, the terrorists, what they're trying to do is to demoralize the country, break down the financial system, and create a communal divide, you know, against the Muslims. And they haven't succeeded in doing that. Their main objectives have not been successful.
And at this point, as we said, we're not exactly sure who's responsible for what's been happening.
No, we don't know. No, there's nothing. There are sort of fingers being pointed because they say that the boats that came in, you see, these people came in by boat in inflatable dinghies, and that those boats landed at what, the Gateway of India, which is right next to the Taj Hotel. So the Indian intelligence agency says that these boats came from Karachi, but again, it's not been established that. Mm. I mean, they came in a mothership, apparently, and the Navy has got hold of that mothership, and they're finding out, you know, where that... But, I mean, the supposition is that it came from Karachi, these boats. But I don't think anything has been fully established yet.
But they were very well-planned attacks.
Absolutely. It must have taken them at least 2 or 3 months of planning. So it's a bit of a failure of Indian intelligence not to have got wind of it.
Rahul Singh is a journalist who lives next door to the Orthodox Jewish Center in Mumbai, where at least 5 hostages and 2 terrorists were killed today in the attacks that have been taking place across Mumbai since Wednesday. Mumbai, which formerly was called Bombay, is a city of 13 million people. Terrorists struck 10 sites there in coordinated attacks. The Taj Mahal Hotel is one of 2 luxury hotels that were targeted, and that's where Christian Science Monitor correspondent Anoush Chopra is now. And Anoush, we're hearing reports of Indian commando forces fighting room by room, stepping over bodies to reach the gunmen, who appear to be well-trained and very familiar with this hotel. You've been there since Wednesday. What are you hearing and seeing today?
At irregular intervals, we've been hearing deafening explosions inside. We've been hearing the roar of gunfire breaking. And we've seen paramilitary forces taking cover against any possible shrapnel that might fly their way. they're in the process of storming the building and trying to seize control of it, but it's obviously a huge task.
So what does it look like? I mean, are the windows broken? Are there big holes in the walls? I mean, describe to me what it looks like outside the hotel.
You know, from the outside, from a distance, it looks quite all right. But situation from inside is what is absolutely creepy. I was just interviewing a bomb defusal expert. He mentioned that it's absolutely shocking inside. Furniture is broken. Furniture is burnt. And there is this pungent smell of chemicals because of the incessant explosions and gunfire. There are dead bodies everywhere, is what he said. Blood splattered across floors. I've been here 6 months ago, and getting inside, you have mirrors everywhere on almost every floor, and even if you try and climb up the fire escape, the person on the above floor will know that someone is approaching him. The bomb defusal expert also said that was one big challenge, that they had to be extremely, extremely cautious on how to approach. Another main reason why it's taking so much time is because these terrorists are using human shields. They've taken hostages, and they're using them as human shields.
Do we know how many people are inside?
If you just heard, that was another explosion.
And that was just an explosion?
Yes, that was an explosion inside the hotel, probably another grenade attack.
And do you think that grenade attack is from whom?
Right, that is another puzzle every time. We don't know if that's a grenade attack from by the terrorists or the paramilitary forces. But they're obviously engaged in a fierce battle inside.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of people who are also gathered in the street watching what's going on?
Oh, absolutely. I've been coming here since I was a child. I've seen Bombay as this bustling city, full of life, full of people. And yesterday was the first time when I saw streets eerily deserted and empty. People stayed back at home. Schools and colleges were shut. The stock market was shut. But today life seems to be back to normal. And the mood of the crowd is there is a sort of sense of jingoism is what I sense. You know, crowds, whenever they see a truck pull in and paramilitary forces get out, they yell, "Finish them off," is what I heard. One of the sentiments emerging from an onlooker. Just today as well, I heard an angry outburst of one of the onlookers who said, you know, how can you allow a bunch of young men to take India hostage for 3 days? So that really sums up the mood of the crowd over here.
Mm-hmm.
Even this afternoon, there was this false alarm of another shootout in an area, and people were rushing and turning back their cars, and the government sent in truckloads of paramilitary forces to the street. The drama just went on for an hour before everyone realized that this was a false alarm.
Anoush, what does it feel like to be covering this story?
A little creepy because, I mean, I was in Bombay 2 years ago when commuter trains were bombed. I was at a train station just the next day, and I saw that life was back to normal. We saw people fearlessly boarding the same commuter trains that were bombed, and the sentiment was, you know, that we'd rather risk our lives than risk our jobs. But yesterday, I think Mumbai was in a state of shock at the sheer audacity of this attack. Never before have we seen young men wielding guns storm into five-star hotels and randomly opening fire at innocent people. The city is still in a state of shock and is still absorbing all this. The false alarm of today sort of sums up the fear that underlies the population over here.
Well, Anoush Chopra, a South India correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who's been speaking with us from Mumbai, India. Thank you very much for being with us, Anoush.
Pleasure. Thank you.
These attacks in Mumbai are reverberating across India, with many people calling on the government to take strong, decisive action. Veer Singh is a veteran freelance journalist in India. He's been following the events from the capital city, New Delhi. And Veer, you're from Mumbai. What are you hearing from people you know there?
Yeah, well, I grew up there. I haven't lived there for many years, but I'm very familiar with the neighborhood in which all of this has been taking place. Of course, a lot of what I'm hearing is people who knew people who were staying or were at least visiting one of these two luxury hotels. You know, there's stories of families that have not accounted for two people. There's a story of a lady and her two children who were, burnt to death in the restaurant at the Oberoi Trident Hotel. I have a friend, you know, from the corporate world who's been attending two funerals today. So, you know, yes, when you hear that, I mean, these very specific incidents, put into relief what you've been hearing about a very somber mood. The scale of this thing has shocked people, and you are, even yesterday, beginning to see the beginnings of some very angry reactions by citizens there.
And they're angry. Are they angry at the government?
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, one prominent commentator was, was saying, what is this people talking about, the stoicism, the will-do, the can-do spirit that has characterized Bombay, Bombay will stand up again and all of that. I mean, she said that really begs the question of, why did this, why could such a thing even happen? I mean, we have a Coast Guard, a Navy.
What about, at this point, what are we hearing in terms of who the terrorists are?
What we are hearing from the government is that the people who carried out this attack, the actual gunmen, had support from outside. But it's also important to note that the Indian government has stopped short of actually blaming a foreign government. The intelligence agency of Pakistan used to be named as a primary suspect in earlier years. This time they have been careful to steer clear of that. They have tried to put the focus instead on the fact that there are terrorist groups operating on foreign soil, not just in Pakistan, but in Bangladesh as well. The Indian government doesn't name any country, specifically, but their messages are always nuanced to indicate that they are talking about India's neighbors. So they're trying to put pressure on governments in neighboring countries to crack down on so-called terrorist outfits that are training people for just the sort of attacks you've seen, not just in India, but elsewhere as well. You know, there are certainly enough signs to suggest in this instance that it is a group of people that, calls itself, Islamist, but we just don't have a clear picture. There is a view that it's not one network. It's scattered groups that are radicalized. There's a sense in India that, if we mention, a particular religious community, or people coming from, a particular country, it can set off a lot of bloodletting. So we need to know a little more before we really, the previous speaker was saying that there were cries of hang them, let's get this over with, let's catch these people and string them up, if you will. That can be a very dangerous thing in India.
Well, Veer Singh, freelance journalist who is in New Delhi, India's capital, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
As we've mentioned, at least two Americans were killed in the attacks in Mumbai. The State Department says they were 58-year-old Alan Scher and his 13-year-old daughter Naomi. They are from Virginia. When we come back, we'll take a closer look at one group claiming responsibility for the attacks. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. We're continuing our coverage of the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India, where an estimated 160 people have been killed in attacks on 10 sites across the city that began Wednesday night. In recent years, there have been several terrorist attacks in India, many of them blamed on Muslim militants. But these attacks are different. They're more sophisticated, they're more brazen, and they were obviously well planned. Sugathu Bose is director of the South Asia Initiative at Harvard University. He's a native of India, and he joins us now in the studio. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
You must be in contact with folks in India. What are you hearing from them?
Well, I've been in constant touch with family and friends in India, and the whole country is, watching the events in Mumbai unfold. I've recently been told that the situation at the Oberoi Trident Hotel and Nariman House has been brought under control, even though, as you reported, it's very sad that the five hostages in Nariman House have been killed. And I'm hearing, as you are hearing, that the fight is still going on at the Taj Mahal Hotel. Right. It is a hotel where I have stayed on many occasions. I was last there in July of this year.
Hmm. And the big question is, who is responsible for all of this at this point? When you look at these attacks and you see that the attackers apparently came in by sea and knew the layout of these hotels and the layout of the city very well, and it was very brazen. They just walked into these luxury hotels and really opened fire. Is there anything in history to suggest who might have done this or why they might have done it now?
The short answer is that we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. But as you said, these were sophisticated and brazen attacks. There have been a series of terrorist attacks in Indian cities in the last 2 or 3 years, but most of them have been sort of rather cowardly attacks with timed explosive devices. There were bombs left on commuter trains in Bombay. There have been bombs that have been left in markets in Delhi. But, this kind of frontal assault is relatively rare in Indian cities outside of Kashmir. So I can think of only, one major attack by five militants armed with guns and grenades in December 2001. This was the attack on India's parliament when there were hundreds of parliamentarians inside attending a session, and nine guards were killed, and the five militants were also killed in an hour-long battle, and they were prevented from going in. In addition to that, there's been one such frontal attack in Gujarat, outside of Kashmir. But between 1999 and 2003, there were these kinds of frontal attacks, usually by duos, two-man sort of teams, against mostly military targets in Kashmir. And even though they died down from 2004, I remember in July 2005, I was in Srinagar in Kashmir, and there was this kind of a frontal attack, an attack on Indian soldiers, and then the two militants hold themselves up in a hotel in downtown Srinagar. Mm-hmm. Now, these kinds of frontal assaults in Kashmir in the very late 1990s and the early years of this century were typically launched by a group known as the Lashkar-e-Toyba. Mm-hmm. And also to some extent another group known as the Jaish-e-Mohammed. But this sort of thing happening in a big Indian city is a new phenomenon and could, signal a new era in urban terrorism in India.
The groups that you mentioned in the past, what are they trying to accomplish with these attacks? And do we have any sense that we know what the terrorists in these attacks in Mumbai are trying to accomplish?
Well, in the past, of course, the attacks in Kashmir were to try and, win a political battle in Kashmir. They were fighting against Indian, rule in Jammu and Kashmir. This one is not clear. While Indian Muslims may have had grievances and were alienated by the anti-Muslim pogrom in Gujarat in 2002, this does not look like a, domestic affair. And at this point, the only thing that the terrorists appear to have achieved is, global media attention that they were seeking. Now, what they want beyond that is unclear. Now, of course, we have to recognize that, both innocent Indians and innocent Pakistanis have been the victims of terrorism of late. Even just a couple of months ago, the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad had been, bombed. And now, of course, two luxury hotels in India, in Mumbai, have been attacked. And it's clear that, the Pakistan government seems to be very keen on not escalating tensions with India. They want to improve relations with India. And in fact, as the attacks were happening in Mumbai, the Pakistan foreign minister was in Delhi holding talks, which were reported to be positive and constructive, with the Indian foreign minister. On the other hand, of course, nothing is domestic in today's world. And there are sort of militant groups that are based in countries outside of India. There are even reports, unconfirmed as yet, whether there might be British nationals involved in the attacks. So everything is globally interconnected.
And we do know that, at least at this point, Pakistan is sending its spy chief over to Mumbai for talks, possibly the helping investigating exactly what might be responsible.
That's right. The Indian Prime Minister requested the Pakistan Prime Minister that the ISI chief, who's newly appointed, ought to be sent over to cooperate in the investigation. And I understand from reports coming out of India that the Pakistan Prime Minister has obliged and that the spy chief will be going across to Delhi to cooperate.
So hopefully we'll get some answers, and it's a very very sad, very disturbing story.
It is a very, very sad day here, and yesterday's Thanksgiving was, of course, entirely clouded by the human cost of these terrible attacks.
Right. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sugata Bose is director of the South Asia Initiative at Harvard University. We'll be back after the news. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today is traditionally called Black Friday, the day that retailers hope to get into the black. But economists say this could be the worst holiday shopping season in 20 years. In a moment, we're going to hear from a mall developer about how his industry is faring. But first, we head to the stores. With the retail outlook so bleak, merchants are offering deals of as much as 75% off. And we're going to check in now with a woman who calls herself the ultimate bargain hunter, Denise Selden of East Boston, Massachusetts. Every year, she assembles a team of friends and family. Each person gets a list, and they are dispatched to the stores. This year, she has 8 people on her shopping team, and we reached Denise at a CVS store in Malden, Massachusetts. Denise, how's the shopping going so far?
Shopping is great. We're at about 100% success rate. You can't do better than that.
Okay, how do you judge success rate?
Well, you put together a list of the absolute best buys that are available, and if you're able to actually get them, then that's success.
What time did you get to the stores this morning?
I myself started at 4, which was a later start than normal for myself.
4 a.m.? Where did you go first?
Target.
And were there people in line, and what'd you get when you were there?
There were people in line. The store opened at 6 a.m., and the main item that I was looking for this year was the Guitar Hero, the newest edition, the World Tour.
And what kind of a deal did you get?
They were on sale for $60, and that's probably about a $40 savings.
So shopping, would you say, is strong and sales are good, or how would you describe it?
I would say that sales are okay. They're not as great as I've seen in the past, but shopping is strong. People are out here.
Okay, well, let's check in with some members of your team here. We have your son, Joe Rugnetta, on the line, and your half-sister,
yes,
Melissa DiPlacido. Joe, let's start with you. Where are you?
Right now, I'm in A.J. Wright.
A.J. Wright. Now, I heard you started even earlier than your mom before 4 a.m. today?
Oh, yeah, I was at Best Buy at midnight.
You're at Best Buy at midnight. What'd you get?
32-inch flat screen.
Did you get a good deal?
Yeah, very good deal. It was $3.99.
And Melissa, where are you right now?
I am in Kohl's.
You're in Kohl's. And what time did you start today?
I started at 3.
You started at 3 a.m. At Kohl's,
yep.
Or where did you start?
No, I went to Toys R Us first.
And?
And I was looking for the My Size Dora.
Mm-hmm.
That I was able to get.
Now, you guys are sort of the soldiers here, and Denise is the general, huh?
Yep, she is.
You have a whole military strategy for your Black Friday shopping.
Yep, she organizes us and tells us when and where and what.
And you've been doing this. This is part of your Thanksgiving ritual. You guys have been doing this for years now?
Yep. After we eat, the kids go away, and we pull out the circulars and map everything out, and we all have our cell phones on, and we're in constant communication.
And Denise, how much do you plan to spend this year?
Well, the total team is probably close to $4,000, I would guess.
And how many people does that buy gifts for?
20, I would have to think.
Mm-hmm. And are you concerned about, we spoke with you earlier this week when we were talking about your shopping strategy, and you said you work as a hairdresser. You rely on tips a lot. Business is down a little bit. Are you concerned about spending this much during the holidays? Is any kind of cutting back? Is $4,000 lower than usual?
No, I'm not going to say I'm doing my part to stimulate the economy. That's what I'm doing.
Well, all right. Well, good luck to you. Joe Rugnetta and Melissa DiPlacido, thanks very much for being with us and happy shopping today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Denise Selden is of East Boston, Massachusetts. And Black Friday is your favorite day of the year. Is that right, Denise?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, happy shopping.
Thank you.
Well, Denise's story must be music to the ears of Scott Leventhal. He's director of development for Garden Commercial Properties in Short Hills, New Jersey. The financial crisis is hurting his industry, where about one in five of the country's largest regional malls is failing. And Scott, Newsweek.com recently asked, is the mall dead? You plan to open three malls soon. Are you still moving forward with those plans?
We have had commitments from many large retailers who generally plan well in advance of the downturn that we're experiencing in the economy and in the retail sector in general. And we had every intention, based on having financing in place and commitments from retailers, to proceed with those transactions, and are beginning to see those tenants opening even in these downtimes.
So you do have tenants for your three malls in New Jersey?
We do. They're primarily discount department store and supermarket anchored locations.
You know, we've been reading about a growing trend in malls where there are lifestyle centers and parks and residential space or office space along with the mall. Is that something that's on your radar as well?
It's not only on our radar, but it is almost primarily the only types of properties that we are looking forward to continuing to develop in the near future. We believe that it allows us to hedge our bets and provide what is becoming a trend, and that is people wanting something more than simply a sea of asphalt and a discount department store at the other end of that parking field. The Main Street component is what will make this new and exciting and different, and something that I think we're all going to see in the future as we look at development.
You know, in our area, in the greater Boston area, we have a sort of high-end lifestyle center. It's called the Natick Collection, and it's got million-dollar condominiums attached to the mall, and it's a very large shopping center with restaurants and theaters and such. Yet, the parent company of the facility needs $1 billion to remain solvent. Do you think that there's a message in that for high-end retailers at all?
Well, I don't know that the problems that are being experienced by that particular mall developer, and I am familiar with both that property as well as the developer, may not be indicative of that property type. Clearly, some of the markets that that particular developer as having troubles in have greater economic issues that they're dealing with from foreclosures, from a lack of jobs and other issues that are associated with the parent company and not particularly that particular project. So I do think there still is room for these mixed-use projects that contain retail, housing, entertainment opportunities, as well as civic space and entertainment. So we still think that there is room for it. Some of the high-end malls will experience problems. There's going to be fallout in the first and second quarter of 2009. There's no question we're going to see additional retail bankruptcies, primarily because of the two C's, consumer confidence, and the other is credit. And by virtue of a lack of consumer confidence, as well as the difficulty of many of these retailers to extend credit terms, we're going to see more fallout in 2009.
So how many malls will you open in the next year, Scott?
Well, in 2009, we'll have two retail malls that will open. We've got three that will be in construction. So we're continuing to feel that although the market is fragile and certainly compared to other sectors, still remains a rather strong development opportunity, we still are trying to remain bullish on retail in maybe not the short term, but certainly the mid and long term as something that will remain a fabric of our society. People like to shop, and maybe they'll shop for less, but people will still go to the malls, certainly if you could provide them with an environment that's exciting and that's sustainable for the future. So we certainly have scaled back, but we continue to look forward to proceeding in the future.
Scott Leventhal is Director of Development for Garden Commercial Properties in Short Hills, New Jersey. Scott, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure.
We turn now to Kathleen Siders. She's Associate Professor of Marketing at Boston College and a retail expert. And Kathleen, let's talk about some of the points that Scott Leventhal brought up. He basically says, yes, the market is fragile, but the retail picture is okay, and they're going to proceed fairly aggressively with their plans for more malls.
Well, I think it depends where you are on the spectrum. There are lots of different kinds of malls. There are strip malls, there are outlet malls, there are regional malls, there are super regional malls, and there are luxury malls. He's at the lower end of the market, which is certainly the best place to be.
So the discount stores are doing well.
Right.
And so we have one Newsweek article proclaiming, is the mall dead? We have a developer who says, no, it's not necessarily dead. It's just being revised a little bit, either to have more of a mixed use or to maybe focus on discount shoppers. What's your take? Is the mall dead?
The mall is dead is a periodic message. This Time magazine cover is from 1998, and it says, kiss your mall goodbye. And I remembered this.
So that was 10 years ago. So what did we do in response to saying goodbye to the mall in 1998? Did we learn anything? And is this just sort of a cyclical thing then that we're doing?
I think it is. This was related to the internet boom that didn't really happen. But yeah, malls are definitely here to stay. And certainly you see different trends in malls, just like you see trends in any other kind of business. But I personally believe that the mall developers have overdone it. When you look at statistics in terms of mall square footage per capita, that's increased 30% in the last 20 years. And that's a very significant percentage. And when you look at the space that's occupied, that now is 62%. Last year it was 72%. So that also shows you the same trend, that I think that we do have overstoring and we have overmalling. And that's a problem, because when companies move out of these spaces and they leave these big dead stores and even dead malls, it blights our landscape.
Who's doing the best right now, would you say? Who's in terms of stores, who's expanding, and then in terms of malls?
Well, Walmart is really on top right now, and some of the warehouse clubs have done very well. BJ's and Costco has had pretty good numbers. So, and you see different product categories doing better as well. And interestingly, the stores that sell food and beverages are really benefiting, because people are buying more food, more beverages, more liquor now, because they're eating at home. And so you see a lot of those gains in those stores related to food.
You mentioned the internet. What kind of a role has the internet played in all of this? In 1998, if the Time headline was, you know, kiss your mall goodbye because of the internet, have we seen the internet really make a significant impact on mall shopping, would you say?
Well, we have to some extent. And this season is very odd, because expecting 1% gain is so unusual after double-digit increases every year. And part of that problem also relates to profitability, because 75% of shoppers expect free shipping. So if people are only going to shop with free shipping on top of good deals, then those retailers are not going to be in good shape at the end of the season.
What about the Main Street component of the mall? That seems to be also something that's very popular now, that people feel as if they're walking outside when they're shopping.
I think people want to move away from that claustrophobic mall feeling, and so you have this new model, like the Disney World model. Everything's very manicured, but there's a sense that you're in a more intimate kind of environment. So you see different trends like that, but it doesn't mean that malls are leaving us. It means that malls evolve.
So if we've overdeveloped, we have too many malls, do you think that we will see a real decline in the number of malls anytime soon?
I think that we will. It depends on what the shakeout is like at the end of this season. The thing that worries me the most as far as the health of the retailing industry is that Chapter 11 no longer exists in its original form. Companies used to file Chapter 11, were protected from their creditors, could reorganize and stay alive. But now they don't have the funds, they don't have access to the credit to reorganize and stay alive. So we're seeing them begin to liquidate. And if these companies liquidate, we're going to have a lot of empty stores and a lot of unemployed people. And that's a very frightening thought.
Kathleen Siders, Associate Professor of Marketing at Boston College's Carroll School of Management. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So after you've made a dozen turkey sandwiches and you still have a lot of the bird left, plus a refrigerator full of leftover side dishes, what to do? Well, last Thanksgiving, we turned to the woman who's written a book on that very topic, Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. This year, we decided to reheat her conversation with Here and Now's Robin Young.
And as we said, you love leftovers so much, you wrote a book about them called Leftovers.
Yeah, very creative title.
And some people are frightened by the issue. Let's start with that.
It's really a mindset. It's the glass half empty, glass half full syndrome. You know, when I open the refrigerator the day after Thanksgiving, I see a world of possibilities. I see pot pies and potato pancakes and cranberry sauces over ice cream and frittatas and on and on and on. And most people see tinfoil and be like, I can't deal with this. Let's just get rid of it. And let's face it, we are a society that has just begun to embrace recycling on a serious level. And the whole environmental issue kind of spills over to the way that we look at leftovers. Is it new possibilities where most of the work's been done, or is it drudgery? I see it as possibilities.
Well, and some people feel it tastes better the second day around.
Well, that's true for a lot of it. Any kind of soups or stews or stocks. The thing about the turkey, first of all, you're going to get sick of it. There's no way around it.
You know, when you stop you there, are you going to get sick? Should you take it all off the bone and not leave it on the bone?
It doesn't matter. Except that if you don't take it off the bone, you're going to miss a great opportunity, which is to use the turkey carcass to make a stock. Now, don't get scared by that word. All it means is you're going to take the meat off, and I would say freeze half of it, because after the holidays, in the middle of January, the idea of fresh roasted turkey is going to sound really good again. Mm. So keep half of it, and I'll take you through some ideas there. But the carcass, you put it in a pot, a few onions, some carrots, some celery, some water, salt and pepper. And turkey stock is so much more interesting than chicken stock. It's richer and it's sort of a fuller flavor. One of my favorite leftovers is to make the turkey stock. And then I do a Greek lemon rice soup where you take the stock, you add a beaten up egg yolk, a little bit of fresh lemon juice, some of the leftover turkey, some leftover rice, or cook up a pot of fresh rice. And I brought you some.
I'd love to taste that.
Oh, it's still nice and warm. But this is comfort food, and it's also deeply refreshing because of the lemon. One of the things about the holidays is all the rich flavors tend to make us feel heavy and weighed down. And you just want something light and fresh tasting, but also comforting.
Boy, this lemon is so strong.
Well, this is a Meyer lemon. You start to find Meyer lemons around this time of year. Many people think that they're much stronger than a regular lemon. I just think it's a purer lemon flavor. You can look for them in special fruit and vegetable stands, and they tend to be smaller and softer, and the juice just pours out.
Spell that, Meyer.
M-E-Y-E-R. It was named for a Mr. Myers, who was a scientist, and these trees were propagated, and they're called Meyer lemons, and they're starting to become much more available, and they're well worth looking for.
Boy, that's powerful. You got a slice of one right here. Powerful.
Yeah, it really adds a good zip to that soup.
I was thinking, too, yes, light is appreciated, but if you want to go a little heavier, couldn't you do something with coconut milk and go more towards a Thai
flavor? Oh, you could
flavor?
Turn that so easily. It's a great idea. Instead of the rice, you could add rice noodles. You could add some coconut milk and fresh ginger. Mm-hmm. Ginger and lemon and lime. These are flavors as we enter this season where everything gets kind of weighed down by cream and butter, where your palate gets very excited because it's light and fresh and really vibrant. That soup is always a hit.
Delicious. Kathy's turkey lemon rice soup. We'll have the recipes on our website, here-now.org. I'm thinking, too, many of us just dragged in our pots and herbs from the garden, and cilantro, the stuff I'm trying to use up.
That would be wonderful, particularly in that sort of an Asian version of this soup. But when you bring those herbs in, you know, often if you have even a slightly sunny windowsill, they will keep going. So keep them there. But again, those can be dried, they can be frozen, and you'll be able to use them all winter.
We want to get some other ideas from you for using the leftovers in Thanksgiving. You'd ask me to, bring in one of mine. This is very difficult. Kathy, I don't know if you really should attempt this, if people at home could attempt this without injuring themselves.
I'm nervous.
It's the silliest thing. It's a leftover pot pie. I just put on the bottom of the pie plate the stuffing, then layers of turkey, and then put the mashed potatoes on top with maybe some cheese, and that's it.
Oh, perfect. So the mashed potatoes, the crust.
Yeah, and sometimes, gravy goes in, or I just pour a little apple juice down the side or something.
Yeah, keep it moist.
And that, it's just so simple.
I'm getting worried, Robin. I think you're going to steal my job here. That sounds really... Yeah. Pot pies are terrific. You don't have to make homemade pastry. You can buy a pre-made crust.
Right. I don't even put a crust. Just leftovers.
Mashed potatoes. Leftover mashed potatoes. Whether you have sweet potatoes. I love to make potato pancakes the next morning or a few mornings later where you simply form the leftover mashed potatoes. Let them get room temperature into a pancake. And you get a skillet really hot. You don't need butter. Again, we've had all that. Little bit of olive oil, and you fry them up as pancakes into the hot skillet, about 3 or 4 minutes on each side, golden brown with a fried egg in the morning. Really good.
Delicious. Give us another recipe.
You know, frittatas, which are oven-baked omelets, are a great way to use up leftovers, whether it's the string beans from Thanksgiving, whether it's a little bit of the extra stuffing, even the cranberry sauce. You whip together about 6 or 8 eggs, add a tiny bit of milk to that. Maybe you saute some onions, or again, you just throw in the leftover vegetables, put the eggs on top, a little grated cheese, and pop it into a 425-degree oven for about 30 to 40 minutes, and it'll puff up like a souffle. Very dramatic, very simple, but these eggs are suddenly this very interesting, elaborate dish, and it's really all about leftovers. So again, you've transformed something old into something new.
Give us some other ideas. You know, we've got breads. What are some other thoughts?
Breads are a great leftover. What I do is I start saving leftover bread before Thanksgiving to use as stuffing. But the other thing is if you have loaves of bread left over or rolls from your holiday meal, slice them up thin, lightly brush them with olive oil and put them into a hot oven. And then you're going to have the basis for a bruschetta, which is a great holiday appetizer. It's basically like turning your leftover bread into a cracker. It will keep in a nice dry place for several weeks. And then the thing about holidays is that you need good food in your pantry. And that doesn't mean a lot of expensive stuff. Some, you know, in the refrigerator, you have some cream cheese or different interesting cheeses and some chutneys or pepper jellies and things you can put together really quickly and efficiently. But if you take that leftover bread and brush it with the olive oil and just toast it until it's really golden on both sides, that'll get you through a lot of things. Wonderful way to top salads also.
Right. Let's see. Leftover dessert.
Does it exist?
If you've got pie, email me. But, you know, people might have pies and things left over. What to do?
Again, it's the kind of thing where if you've had a lot of sweets, you're probably going to feel sick of it. What's really nice to do is to cut them into individual portions and freeze them so that you can pop them out of your freezer as the holidays unfold and sort of have this homemade dessert that's at the ready without feeling like you're going to eat pumpkin pie every day this weekend until you feel really bad about yourself.
Well, speaking of freezing, and you mentioned it for the meat too, give us some tips.
Well, the thing about freezing is, aside from getting sick of having a lot of excess food, it's a great way to keep it through the season. Small plastic bags get all the air out of it. You want to zip it up really tight. Put it in your freezer, label it, and at the most, you want to give it 2 to 3 months. Things start to get kind of funky after that, and it is a really great way to stretch the leftovers out over the whole winter because it's going to be exciting to see that stuff again in a while.
So those things that I have since the Jimmy Carter
presidency, yeah, of course, right,
should go.
Well, this is a good time of year before we get into the next holiday to go through the freezer, get rid of that stuff so you can put the fresh stuff in and start new.
That's Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. To see her recipes for turkey lemon rice soup and potato pancakes, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Hitesh Hati, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugarts is our technical director. Our web producer is Ken George. Our intern is Shannon Brown. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. And the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young returns Monday. Have a great weekend. And please, join us again, Here and Now.